This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler, and on today's edition, we're looking at emergency talks which have been taking place in Paris in the last few hours, linked to US attempts to end the war in Ukraine. Britain's Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, has described it as a once-in-a-generation imperative.
The issue of burden sharing is not new, but it is now pressing, and Europeans will have to step up, both in terms of spending and the capabilities that we provide.
But how will Europe step up, and can Ukraine's resistance continue without US support? Also in the show, I find out what happens to the West's electronic products when they grow old and obsolete, and how Canadians are responding to Donald Trump's threats of tariffs by boycotting US products themselves.
I don't think this is a temporary shift in the attitude of Canadian consumers now towards American goods. They no longer are viewing the Americans as a reliable partner and friend.
We'll have more on that later in the show. First, though, this week all the talk is about Ukraine and the relative defence spending of the various NATO allies that are supporting it. European leaders have been meeting in Paris in the last few hours to discuss their response to President Trump's peace initiative with Russia. Can Europe step up to the demand that it spend much more on its defence and indeed take the burden of responsibility in paying for Ukraine's intensive economic and military needs? We're going to look at that question in just a moment. But first, I'm joined by Walter Todd. He's President a Chief Investment Officer of Greenwood Capital in the US. Walter, this has been an extraordinary time for Europe's defence companies, hasn't it? We're seeing value surging across the board in the last few weeks, boosted by this new pledge by European governments to spend more on their armed forces.
Yeah, you've really seen a contrast between those European defence contractors and the US ones. So if you look at some of the major ones in Europe, like Saab and BAE's E-Systems and Leonardo, they're up on average 17% year-to-date. U.S. defense contractors are down about 10% year-to-date. So quite a contrast there.
Yeah, it's so interesting that all of this, I guess, cost-cutting in the U.S., it's natural because defense companies depend on government's budgets for their revenue. I mean, it's interesting, though, because people like Elon Musk will argue, you know, don't spend money on F-15s. Warfare is changing. It's now about the new technology, about drones, cyber weaponry and such like.
Yeah. So if you look at on that point, if you look at a Kratos, which is a U.S. drone maker, they've done quite a bit better than the average U.S. defense contractor. They're up about 3% year to date. But again, Europe's, you know, far outperforming. And I guess that, you know, the thought process there is if they're going to have to spend more money for their defense, they're going to spend it on, you know, companies in their home countries versus necessarily buying from the U.S. manufacturers from that standpoint.
OK, Walter, well, stay with us. Thanks for that. We're going to look a little bit more now at this meeting tonight in Paris, European leaders gathering there for what they're calling an emergency summit on the future of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, where they've indeed pledged to take responsibility for their own security. The British Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, had this to say just after the meeting finished.
On defence, it's clear the US is not going to leave NATO. But we Europeans will have to do more. The issue of burden sharing is not new, but it is now pressing, and Europeans will have to step up, both in terms of spending and the capabilities that we provide. On Ukraine, we're at the very early stage of the process. Europe must play its role, and I'm prepared to consider committing British forces on the ground alongside others if there is a lasting peace agreement. But there must be a US backstop, because a US security guarantee is the only way to effectively deter Russia from attacking Ukraine again.
That's Britain's Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer. Poland's Donald Tusk has indeed echoed that sentiment that European governments need to spend more now on defence. Matthew Saville, he's a director of military sciences at the UK-based military think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, is with us now. Matthew, he's talking there, isn't he, about the possibility of Britain participating in a European peacekeeping mission once a deal is signed, if it's signed. Of course, there must be a US backstop, he says. Other European nations are a little bit more divided on this question, it seems.
Good evening. Yes. So coming out of this meeting today, and admittedly, this is sort of a very early reaction, there seems to have been a pretty lukewarm response to the idea of deploying European personnel into Ukraine. And to the extent that it only really seems to be France, maybe the UK and perhaps Sweden who are leaning that way, and others, particularly Germany, seem to be very much more sceptical than Chancellor Scholz left, declaring this to be an inappropriate discussion. I think, in truth, a lot of this looks like scrambling to respond to having now been told in no uncertain terms that the US expects Europe to be leading on defence and security, and particularly on Ukraine.
Yeah, so let's talk the numbers. I mean, as we have seen them for the last 3 years, since the war started, the US initially was the main contributor, wasn't it, to Ukraine's economic and security requirements at that point. Now, in cash terms, at least, Europe has edged fractionally ahead, I believe. Is that right?
Yes. So the US is still overwhelmingly the single largest contributor to Ukraine. Europe, and by that we mean both EU institutions and individual European countries, actually now combined provide more aid overall. And that's because there's been a lot of political and humanitarian aid. But military aid, there is now parity. The issue is that they have in many cases emptied out their own stockpiles or spent as much as they can buying other weapons in. And the US is the source of some of those. And in addition, the US provides a lot of the most sophisticated weapons that the Ukrainians need, particularly air defense missiles and some of the other kind of niche weapons that Ukraine is really after.
Right. So it's not just about the volume of spending, it's about the quality of the spending and what it's going on. The pressure from the US now is for ever greater European defence spending. Of course, we are seeing that, aren't we, as we've just been hearing. Not all nations, though, are meeting the target of 2% of GDP. The US wants 3% target. Some are pushing in that direction. I'm curious, is part of the problem here that it's all piecemeal, that Europe is just collectively spending billions, but it's not really joined up spending the way that it would be in the United States, because, of course, it's one military there.
It's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, even the US would admit that some of their defence spending is enormously wasteful, and they have a whole series of reasons why some of their procurement goes massively over budget or is inefficient. So I think they would admit they're not perfect, but the sheer volume that they spend, as much as the next sort of 20 or so countries combined, digs them out of a lot of a hole. On the European side, there has been a considerable increase, particularly in the past 10, 11 years since the NATO summit in Wales on defence spending. But they are coming from a fairly low baseline. And they're having to fill in gaps in their forces, deal with recruitment issues. And the fact that a lot of what they're buying is, you know, very drawn out, it becomes individually very expensive. So Germany, you know, the 2% figure is a political target, but always remember it's set against GDP. So German GDP is large. Germany spends a lot now, I think actually more than the UK. But they have been underinvesting for so long that it turns out that many of their forces aren't ready to deploy. And that's true in many other cases. And the UK faces this challenge as well. We have small, expensive forces with gaps that increased spending would have to go to fill.
Now, Sir Keir Starmer, we're just hearing from him. He said, you know, he would put perhaps troops on the ground in Poland, in Ukraine as a part of a peacekeeping force. But there had to be, he said, a US backstop. Let's speculate for a moment. If the US were to push ahead this week, they're talking tomorrow bilaterally with Russia in Saudi Arabia. There is, you know, the prospect, I suppose, some would say, of some kind of bilateral deal being thrashed out without Europe or Ukraine present in the room at that point. Could Europe support Ukraine for a period of months at least now in its pursuit of in its defense, if it wanted to carry on prosecuting a war without U.S. Practical support?
I mean, it's difficult to really know the detail because we don't like have that kind of deep detailed insight into European procurement. Europe has the money to provide considerable support to Ukraine, but it would need to prioritize that going into procurement or funding Ukrainian defense industry, which has benefited from a lot of external support. The other problem is European industrial capacity, about which we know a little bit, but it is coming from a standing start. So the problem is that over, say, 2 or 3 or 4 years, Europe could pour considerable money into production lines for not just artillery, but armored vehicles, missiles, and weapons systems. That's not going to help the Ukrainians this year. Okay. That's where the problem is.
Matthew Saville, thank you very much indeed. Now, there are reports of Canadians boycotting US goods in shops after President Trump threatened last month to impose tariffs on Canadian goods. He also mused about Canada becoming a 51st US state, you may remember. At the weekend, the crowd at one ice hockey game between the US and Canada voiced their disquiet by booing the US national anthem. A rendition of O Canada, meanwhile, received this rousing response. Well, there you go. In case you're wondering, the US did in fact go on to win that game 3-1. But the unhappiness around US-Canada relations has also, it seems, spilled over into the shops as well. Gary Sands is Senior Vice President of the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers, and he told me what he's been seeing.
It's behavior that I've never seen in all the years I've been in the food industry here in Canada, which is about 23, 24 years now. It's an unprecedented demand for made in Canada, product of Canada, and anything but American. So retailers are responding with signage, obviously, identifying the products that are made in Canada. They're also doubling down on efforts to source products from non-American jurisdictions. To be frank, it's almost like unorganized boycott has started to grab hold of the Canadian consumer.
Give me some examples.
We're seeing the sale in beer and wine, for example, that comes from American jurisdictions, significant drops in that. We're seeing consumers look to apple juice as opposed to Florida orange juice. The same with other packaged goods that are too numerous to mention because we have such a close relationship with the United States. But again, what the retailers, my members, are telling me is it's an unprecedented surge in demand for Canadian or non-American products.
But, I mean, grocers must be worried too, though, right? I mean, there is still this threat of tariffs hanging over Canada, potentially. And I was reading that is a substantial chunk of produce in the shops is going to have a supply chain running through the U.S.
Well, our supply chain with the Americans is one that's very closely integrated. It's interdependent, interconnected. We do just over $1 trillion, that's with a T, dollars worth of a business a year between the two countries. There's no doubt that if the tariffs materialize, and we're expecting that they will in a couple of weeks, it's going to have a seismic impact on the consumers, actually on both sides of the border. But yes, you're right to go back to one of your earlier points. 80% of our produce in Canada is sourced from the United States. That's the fresh vegetables and fruit. Now, a lot of that we can offset in the growing season, but in Canada, there's a lot of fruit and vegetables that we can't grow year round, bananas, oranges, lettuce. So we will have to be looking at other jurisdictions for sources. We'll have to be looking at other investments that we can make in greenhouse technologies. It will be a rough ride. We're under no illusions that this is going to be a painless transition away from the American market. It will be tough, but I think it's pretty clear that that's where we're heading.
Really? Is it affecting prices already?
No, not yet, but there's no doubt that it will affect prices. There's just no way that you can slap a 25% tariff, which is really a tax, on every single product that's on a grocery shelf, and there's not going to be an impact on prices. Of course, there will be. And I just have to stress, too, for your listeners, you know, Canada also is made up of a myriad of rural and remote communities and Indigenous communities, where the cost of transportation and distribution of food in those areas is already higher. So this is going to have a disproportionately more significant impact on those communities. And we're, you know, treading almost into the area of food security. So this is very worrying, and Canada is definitely going to have to develop some strategies for the long term, as I said, to unhook us, for lack of a better word, from the dependence we've had on the American market.
Canadian businesses, though, will be cashing in right now, or some of them will, I guess. Some are putting up signs, I see, buy Canadian. Buy Canadian instead. You can see it in your shop window.
You can. You're seeing it on products, even on the TV commercials. You're seeing on television, almost every company is advertising that they're Canadian or not American. It's almost like a tidal wave. I don't think this is a temporary shift. I think you've seen a fundamental shift in the attitude of Canadian consumers now towards American goods, or good or bad, because they no longer are viewing the Americans as a reliable partner and friend. And that's just not me speaking. That's just the attitude that you're seeing everywhere and hearing everywhere.
Gary Sands of the Canadian Federation of Independent Grocers here on World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Back to our markets guest, Walter Todd of Greenwood Capital, for a quick thought on that. Interesting, isn't it? I guess some might have thought that the threat of across-the-board tariffs against Canada, Mexico and others might have dissipated after the threat was suspended on February the 4th. Clearly, Gary Sands doesn't think so.
Yeah, all this happening and the tariffs haven't even been implemented. I mean, hopefully, if they do get implemented as short term and as a means to an end of renegotiating a trade deal. But it's kind of an imbalanced dynamic here. 77% of Canadian exports go to the U.S., but only 15% of the U.S. exports go to Canada. So hopefully we can figure something out and move forward.
Okay, Malte Todd there of Greenwood Capital. Thanks very much indeed.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates, fly better.
Now, South Korea has restricted access to DeepSeek. This is the new Chinese-made AI platform. South Korean regulator is now preventing people from downloading the Chinese AI chatbot over concerns about how it may be using customers' data, at least until a review in South Korea of its personal data collection practices has been carried out. DeepSeek has been surprising investors, of course, of late, and the US tech industry with its ability to match the functions of its Western counterparts at a fraction of the cost. Angela Zhang is a professor of finance at IMIT University in Australia.
South Korea banned DeepSeek by citing some concerns over its data collection practices, also national security fears, as well as foreign government interference.
Yeah, and it's not the first to do this, is it? I mean, Italy has launched an investigation into DeepSeek over Italian users' data. We've got Taiwan, which has banned workers in the public sector there and other key infrastructure facilities from using DeepSeek. Australia has followed suit. Is this starting to look like a trend against DeepSeek because of its, well, I suppose the fear that it could represent some kind of a threat to the safety of data among consumers around the world.
Absolutely. I would say that there are future implications. First, as you can see, South Korea is joining several other countries in the ban of DeepSeek. And this ban also reflects, you know, a broader trend of governments worldwide scrutinizing foreign apps for data privacy and security, which can lead to stricter regulations. The data collection practices actually involve transmitting user data to overseas servers, which could raise alarms about unauthorized access and misuse of sensitive information. And it also depends on the local data protection laws. For example, in South Korea's case, South Korea highlights that the app did not fully comply with the strict data protection laws in South Korea, especially the Personal Information Protection Act.
Is there any way that this type of technology can ever evolve without this kind of political interference? Because it seems like it's become so indelibly politicized, is going to constantly be mired in this suspicion.
Yes, that, as discussed, this is a very complicated issue. And the response from DC is that it plans to strengthen the cooperation between major countries' supervisory organizations as a result of the response to, these security issues. So one of the way going forward is about how you store your data. But there are, of course, other concerns from, the political perspective that I don't think we'll be able to easily solve.
That's Angela Zhang, Professor of Finance at IMIT University in Australia. Now then, our ever-increasing appetite for the latest technology, smartphones or smart TVs perhaps, well, it may have its downside. Obviously, whatever we've had before tends to get discarded when we get the new thing, at which point much of it gets shipped off legally or illegally to low-income countries. Countries like Ghana, for example, which I visited recently. And whilst I was there in the capital, I went to visit what's become one of the continent's biggest e-waste dump sites. I'm in a place called Agbogbloshie, which is the biggest dump of its kind in West Africa. It's a huge multi-kilometre site. You can hear them banging behind me. They're breaking apart bits of car engines, fridges, axles of wheels, and in some cases, computers with all of the rare earth metals that they contain, just to get at whatever they can salvage from the corpses of these old machines. One trader, Mohammed, bent over a pile of old power cables, showed me what he was doing.
Well, this is your copper.
The copper. So you're going to burn the cables to get the copper out?
Yes.
How does it make you feel in your health? How is your health?
We know that it's not good, but we're not getting work. So we have to manage them.
Do people here get sick in the dump?
All the time. Everybody, all the time, will feel fall sick.
That was a computer screen once.
My name is Abdul Wakilo.
Hi, Abdul. How many guys work for you?
Oh, there are plenty.
Plenty?
Yeah.
You have a big team?
Yeah.
And what are they doing?
We are going to touch it and burn it so that this is the copper.
Then you're going to burn these cables and then clean them away so the copper is all that's left, right?
Yeah.
And then how much is the copper worth? What's the value of the copper?
£1 is 60 Ghana.
£1 in weight is 60 CDs, which is maybe $4.
Yeah.
Is it a good business?
It's a good business for us because and feed our family for our house. So it's good for us. Sometimes you will get small, sometimes you will get big.
In front of me, the cables are fizzing and popping. They've got water, which they're squirting on the exposed copper just to cool it down and stop it melting. With his bare hands, he's pulling it apart. It's smouldering hot, and there is stench in the air, honestly. It's hard to describe the thick, choking atmosphere of sewage, but also burning plastics, which dominate the air. Around us there are chickens and goats feeding in amongst the rubbish. And there are children too, small children running around. If you've ever wondered, this is where electronics comes to die.
My name is Mike Anani. I am an environmental journalist. A lot of the young people, they have elevated lead levels in their blood. We're talking about six-year-olds, seven-year-olds. They'll tell me, Mr. Mike, I cannot breathe. Ever since I came here, it is difficult for me to run or play football with my friends. I mean, these children burn, dismantle these electronic waste that are laden with heavy metals, carcinogenic, toxic chemicals, wearing no protective gear, not even gloves. But the developed countries are exporting these things here and poisoning our young people.
Is this unregulated, this trade?
There are international conventions, such as the Basel Convention, that prohibits the transboundary movement of hazardous waste, of which electronic waste is a part. It should not be here in the first place. These are broken computers, television sets. Nobody has been helped in this situation.
There is said to be a huge industry, right, in some of these rarer metals. Do you think there is enough sophistication in the technologies being used to allow this process to happen?
Well, here we don't have that technology. Yeah, I mean, here it is done crudely. It's primitive. They hit them, they smash them with stones, they burn them, and that is not sustainable.
But many of them are making a living out of it. I mean, they're creating the waste by burning these plastics that's causing the problem. I mean, they're doing that to make money, right?
Yes, if you're burning so much toxic waste, that would eventually kill you. No matter the amount of money you're making, it is not worth it. It is not sustainable. So much goes on to hide the electronic waste. This is a problem created by the developed countries, and they should bear the brunt of finding ways to solve it. I mean, this is just not acceptable. It has to end.
Reporter and campaigner Mike Anani. Well, we are seeking a response from the Western electronics goods sector, although, to be honest, there isn't really one overarching consumer body to approach on this subject. The German development agency GIZ has said it is in the midst of delivering a $5 million project to build a new recycling system at Agbog Bloschi, as well as a health clinic and a football pitch for workers. But with 80,000 people working on the site, it could be a while till it comes.
An Bord erwarten Sie Bars, Spa-Duschen sowie preisgekrönte Bordunterhaltung. Es ist also kein Wunder, dass Emirates als beste Fluggesellschaft der Welt ausgezeichnet wurde. Wir fliegen Sie zu über 140 Reisezielen. Und mit unseren Interline-Partnern weltweit bieten wir Ihnen Anschlussflüge zu weiteren 1700 Städten auf 6 Kontinenten. Wenn wir behaupten, dass wir eine der größten internationalen Fluggesellschaften sind, meinen wir, wir bringen Sie an Ihr Wunschziel. Jetzt buchen auf emirates.de. Fly Emirates. Fly better.